People have a habit of confiding terrible secrets in planes. They tell things that would, in a less rarefied atmosphere, remain much more wisely unsaid. A man who told me he was smuggling 15 watches made me so nervous that I was the one blushing, stammering and hesitating at the airport, and was eventually, and very reasonably, searched after this performance, while the smuggler ticked his way unconcernedly to the airport bus. The last time I was coming back from Israel, my neighbour sobbed the whole way from Tel Aviv to London, choking out explanations about how badly she had behaved all summer. She'd never broken the Sabbath until she went to Israel. She'd always eaten kosher until she went to Jerusalem. The irony of it. She wept, and I nearly wept with her. But of course, when we got to London Airport, she'd recovered, and I was the one who couldn't bear to meet her father's eye as he stood there with his long black beard, he who'd always kept the Sabbath and eaten kosher all his life. If people aren't telling you about their operations, their bank balances, the highly unsatisfactory state of their marriages, or how they were cheated by hoteliers, travel agents, and the entire population of whatever country you happen to be leaving, then they're inclined to interrogate you about the most intimate details of your life.
"How can a schoolteacher afford to go to Hong Kong for the summer holidays?" rasped a terrible Australian who was going to be my neighbour for the next 20 hours.
There's no fully satisfactory answer to a question like that, and as I was already afraid that my bank manager could well be waiting on the tarmac in Dublin with the same words on his lips, I couldn't say anything convincing in reply. The Aussie became sour at my refusal to be frank, and began a tirade against all Europeans, who were a miserable, bankrupt lot altogether. "Europeans always sneered at Australians," he went on. "They thought Australians had nothing but beer and going to the beach and sheep stations." He went on and on and on. Singapore, Calcutta, Beirut, Vienna all came and went, and we were still talking about the outback and the Aborigines. We were making maps on our plastic trays of food and letting the ice cream be Queensland and the salt be Perth. We nearly came to blows about the hors d'oeuvre. I said it should be Adelaide. He said it was Melbourne, and since it was his continent, I let it be Melbourne. But the whole journey was exhausting, and I thought longingly of the wonderful journey out, which took 5 weeks, and there was an adventure every single day and nearly 600 people on board ship. Shortly after this marathon flight, I decided that the fault was certainly mine. No one else seemed to have such bad luck, and when I read Helen Gurley Brown's book, Sex and the Single Girl, I knew it must be my fault. Planes, she said, are wonderful places for picking up grade A men. The more international and exciting the flight, the better your chances would be. I had an unworthy suspicion that even the vibrant H.G. Brown wouldn't have made much of old Waltzing Matilda and his White Australia policy, his Wallabies and his test match. However, I decided to follow her instructions on the very next flight. According to Sex and the Single Girl, you should get a seat fairly near the front of the plane, if that's how you get into the plane, presumably. If it's one of the ones where you climb in through the tail, you should sit near the back. Then leave a great big handbag on the seat beside you. At the approach of other women, or grade Z men, you leave the bag there. But when a grade A man approaches, you whip the bag from the seat and stare straight ahead. Once the grade A man is installed, you must establish contact by fumbling over your safety belt, and the intention is to entangle yourself and the man in a knot, from which, with much tinkling laughter, you both extricate yourselves. And such splendid rapport having been made, he offers you a refined cocktail once you're airborne, and things progress from there. Well, I'll say this for S and the SG. The beginning part works like a dream. A man like Marlon Brando sat down beside me. The belt business was a fiasco because he started to fumble with his belt at the same time. And whatever way we seemed to do it, we had to call the air hostess to disentangle us from the muddle. She took so long that I thought she was going to send for an acetylene torch. Anyway, calm was restored and we were airborne. All around us, people were clicking cigarette lighters and ordering refined cocktails. But the false Marlon Brando was staring straight ahead of him. It turned out that he was absolutely terrified of flying. All that business about the safety belt was the last straw, and he seemed to be on the verge of having a very loud and serious fit. When determined to avoid this at all costs, I bought him a scotch. The worst possible thing I should have done, apparently. But it calmed him, and he went to sleep almost at once on my shoulder. Now, the journey from London to Gibraltar is very short, and although it is undoubtedly good for the morale to have a handsome man asleep in my arms, I smiled pityingly at all the people who passed by who had no man at all, it did present grave problems when we got to the rock. He just wouldn't wake up. One of the hostesses thought he was dead, but the other said he was just unconscious. So I had to stay around for what was going to be either a revival or an inquest. I missed my bus to Malaga. I had to deal with Marlon Brando's business partner, who fortunately came to collect him. There was much face-slapping and, "Wake up, Pete, old man." Nobody believed me when I said he was afraid of flying, but everyone agreed that to feed a highly strong man like Pete Scotch whisky was a most foolish and suspect course of action. So whenever I hear about the excitement and glamour of air travel, I'm inclined to be a little cynical. And I look forward to the day when we'll have either single rows of seats or compulsory films that must be watched in silence by the whole plane load. Or better still, the sort of club car Pullman lounges that you see in American films where you can talk to everyone. Until then, we'll just continue to belt ourselves in 2x2 or 3x3 and bore each other to death at altitudes of thousands of feet, flying hundreds of miles an hour all around the world.